Following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And for the last couple of months, I've been reminding our listeners about the upcoming Swamp Gas Conference in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For those who follow the UFO phenomenon, the 1966 Hillsdale, Ann Arbor, Michigan sightings that coined the term swamp gas is well known, but for others, not so much. So today we have Michigan MUFON's State Director, William Kompkaleski, as a return guest to review the events of that case and hopefully catch us up on some of the latest MUFON cases. Bill has been a UFO experiencer since early childhood, and he is the author of the book Experiencer Raised in Two Worlds. So let's welcome Bill Kompkaleski back to the show. Hello, Bill.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on your show.
It is always our pleasure. Always our pleasure. And first of all, we've been touting this Swamp Gas Conference. When is that then again? In March, right?
Yeah, March 19th, which is a Saturday. It runs from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Wyndham Garden in a hotel in Ann Arbor. And we expect a very large crowd for it.
Very good. And I want to remind our listeners, too, because this is, of course, public radio, so no commercials here. But we can talk about events that are done by nonprofit organizations, and MUFON is such an organization. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Yep. We're a 501c3.
Very good. 501c3. I think that means nonprofit.
Nonprofit.
Very good. All right. Then it's at the Wyndham Gardens Hotel. Is that right?
It is, yes. Yeah, it's a really nice hotel if you haven't been there. It has a lot of great spots for people to break out and have conversations about the UFO topic, a nice area for our vendors that's not going to be obscenely far from where the presentations are being given, and it's a really good space.
Good. Yeah.
Right off of the expressway, I-94. I mean, right off the expressway.
Mm. See it from the expressway, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And that's March, what'd you say?
March 19th.
March 19th. Got it right here. March 19th, 2016, just in case somebody's listening to the archives here. But so where can listeners go to, well, it's not really tickets, is it? It's a will call.
It is. Yes, yeah, I've taken a cue from other state chapters that have run conferences and have run into curious situations when it comes to tickets. So, you know, essentially, we're not expecting thousands of people. You know, 500 is the max, so that's going to be a manageable will call list.
Yeah. So where can people go to reserve their will call tickets?
SwampGasUFO.com is our website for it. And if you go to the website, it'll tell you all about the presenters that we have, the venue, and there's a link on there of how to get tickets. You can send in a check if you want. You can reserve your tickets through PayPal and then pick them up at the door, or even get tickets at the door if they're still available.
And it's very reasonable for the whole day, isn't it? $30, isn't it?
Yep, $30, which is quite a bargain for the numbers.
Yeah, with the number of presenters that we're talking about, right?
Yeah, it's going to be a very big deal. A lot of people are unfamiliar with the event, and I think that's a real shame because I always put it up there with some of the great UFO events throughout history. You know, I'm talking about Roswell or the Phoenix Lights, you know, I mean, that sort of quality. There is a lot that went on back in the spring of 1966 that makes this a very important event in UFO history.
Okay, well, tell us about the sequence. This won't be a spoiler because, I mean, this has been around since 1966. So tell us about the sequence of events in the Hillsdale case.
Well, there have been UFO sightings in Michigan, going back to the 1800s. So it's not like this was the beginning of UFO sightings here in Michigan. This just happens to be one of the biggest things that have happened in Michigan of many. And the focus here is on the spring of 1966 because the number of sightings at that time ratcheted up greatly in a very concentrated area. Hillsdale considers itself important in this, rightly so, as does Ann Arbor, Dexter. There's a lot of local communities in southeast Michigan that lay claim to an important piece of this particular event. The area that I always start to focus on when I look at this, because there's just so much going on, is there was a week in 1966 from the 14th to the 21st where so much happened. It starts off on the 14th. Hundreds of witnesses in Ann Arbor saw UFOs flying over. I'm talking about bright lights in the night sky of various different colors, green, blue, white, doing all these fantastic aerial maneuvers. And these sightings were seen in the middle of the night. We have over 100 witnesses between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. And so these things must have been around for a long time, very visible for that many witnesses to have come out during the middle of the night. And as the week progressed, more sightings were seen on the all through the week, building up to the 21st. Now, one of the things that is a big deal about these sightings, and before I get into more of the specifics, is the high volume of police officers that saw these things and were very open about what it was that they saw. Now, one of the police officers who were witnesses to that first event that I had just mentioned on the 14th, Washtenaw County Deputy Sheriff Buford Bushrow, he had said, and I'm going to quote him, he said, "This is the strangest thing that we have ever witnessed. We would have not believed the story if we hadn't seen it with our own eyes. These objects could move at fantastic speeds, make very sharp turns, dive and climb and hover with great maneuverability. We have no idea what these objects were or where they could have come from. At 4:20 a.m., there were four of these objects flying in a line formation in the northwesterly direction, and at 5:30 a.m., these objects went out of view and were not seen again." Now, when you have a police officer coming out and saying something like this, a couple things make that very important. One of these things is that police officers are considered to be expert witnesses. They arrive on the scene of a crime or a car accident, and what they see becomes critical in how, what proceeds next. So they are trained observers. The other thing about police officers that makes it a big deal whenever they have a type of sighting like this and they report it is that the general vibe of police officers is to provide calm, to provide security, to take control of situations. And when you have a police officer saying something like this, this isn't a calming statement. This is something that really shows how shaken they were.
Really?
Yeah, the 17th of that particular week also had dozens of witnesses, including several other police officers. And the 20th and the 21st were two very large days in this particular wave of UFO sightings. The 20th is the date where, besides having dozens of witnesses again, one of these objects apparently landed in a swamp in Dexter next to the farm property of Frank and Ronald Manor, where the two witnesses from the household who had seen a UFO come down next to their property. And they went out to investigate it, and they weren't the only ones that saw the UFO in the swamp. There were Washtenaw County Sheriff's Deputies Stanley McFadden and David Fitzpatrick. Both had seen it, and more importantly, police chief Robert Taylor had also witnessed it. So several police officers and these two people that lived next to the property had witnessed it. Frank and Ronald actually went out to take a closer look at it, and the thing shot off and buzzed the police car that was waiting alongside the road, also watching it. Robert Taylor, the Dexter police chief, Robert Taylor, he sent several police cars in chase of the object. And they actually, police cars chased this thing down Island Lake Road near Ann Arbor. To top things off for this particular week, the very next day was Hillsdale's turn. At about 10:30 p.m. On March 21st, 1966, again, in the women's dorm there at Hillsdale, 17 girls who were in the women's dorm observed a UFO pass by their dorm room. It had all these brightly lit colors on it, red, green, white, pulsating lights. And one of the witnesses, a woman by the name of Gidget Cohn, she called the Hillsdale civil defense number, got a hold of William Bud Van Horn, the civil defense director, who had himself seen one of these UFOs at the beginning of the week on the 14th. And she reported it to him, and he said, well, that's very interesting. If you happen to see it again, let me know. I'm highly interested in this. So half an hour later, the UFO shows up again, and it actually comes down on the property campus, a ball field, a baseball field just on the other side of it. And this time, there were many other witnesses in the dorm. In fact, 87 students and their den mother were watching this UFO hover low over the ground on the Hillsdale's campus on the other side, again, of the ball field. So they call Bud Van Horn again, and he shows up, goes straight to the dorm room, while several police cars, three, I think, fan out around the campus trying to find the UFO, but the interesting thing was the UFO, whenever one of the police cars would get near it, it would dim its lights or shoot off or hide, a variety of things, and the police cars never actually witnessed it from the ground, but from Van Horn's vantage point, as well as the 88 other people he was with, they were all very clearly watching this UFO hover up and down on the campus property. And it was there for so long, actually it was about 5 a.m. before it finally went out of view, that the next day they went out and they took some soil samples, and depending on the story that you read about it, either they got some very fascinating samples that showed that something happened, or other people say, well, the people that did these soil samples really aren't experts and they probably don't know what they're talking about.
But, of course.
I mean, just to have this many witnesses alone, I think, is a very big deal. And this is really only half the story. The other half of the story is what the Air Force did with it when they came in.
Let me, if I could, interrupt a moment. What size and shape was this craft or crafts?
The crafts in general, and there were, again, many, many over the week. Okay. Sometimes there were people would see formations of them, even of up to five flying in formation. But they appear to be about 30 feet across, and depending on how close the witness was to it, It had sort of a pitted exterior, some people said. Some people just saw glowing lights in the sky, but those who had seen it in Hillsdale and in Dexter said it had a very rough exterior to it. And so it was, you know, a little bit bigger than a car.
So it was close enough to some witnesses to rule out the "I saw a light in the sky" routine, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's an understatement.
Right. Okay, so I'm sorry. Go ahead with the, you're talking about the Air Force?
Right. Many people know the name J. Allen Hynek, and it's because of this particular event, I think, that really put his name on the map. For some time, he had been a scientific advisor to the Air Force. He was a college faculty in Illinois that they had brought on as their one of their key UFO investigators. He came out to this particular area to investigate and interview many of the witnesses who had seen things. And it's known that this is the case because he's admitted as such that the Air Force told him specifically, do not raise any suspicion whatsoever that this is extraterrestrial or anomalous or anything like that. So he came out, did his investigation, and he was really impressed with what he had heard and what he had seen. And it's hard to tell on what end of the scale he was a believer at that time or convinced by looking at the proof. A believer is such a term about people being taking things on faith, I guess. But he had seen enough evidence that he was becoming convinced that there was something to this phenomena, and this really pushed him really far in that direction where he was amazed at some of the things he was seeing. So here he is, impressed at the information that he got, that something really happened, and then being told by the Air Force, hey, you know, you got to just blow this one off. You got to say something that will make people think that there really wasn't a UFO event. So he goes and he has an interview with the Detroit Press Club, and you can even find this interview on YouTube. It's very easy to find. And so he goes and he's got all these microphones lined up in front of him, and he's saying, yeah, a lot of people mistook a lot of things that aren't really anomalous, and, you know, isn't it funny that a UFO would come all this way just to land in a swamp, ha ha ha. And he goes, well, people were probably seeing was marsh gas, he was saying, in some of these instances, particularly the one where it came down in the swamp. And the media just loved it. They just ate it up. UFO, you know, Air Force says UFO is nothing but swamp gas or marsh gas. And then, you know, all of the ridicule about the event started, I think, pointed most directly at the Air Force themselves for saying something so silly.
Right.
And then all the cartoons started rolling out and still continue to this day. You know, you see the T-shirts and everything, swamp gases. Everywhere is still as a joke about what the UFO phenomena is. Uh-huh. And, you know, I often say that Michigan is not only the Great Lakes state, it's also the swamp gas state.
Yeah, I've seen cartoons where there is literally a disc-shaped UFO in the sky, and the scientists saying, look, more swamp gas. You know, that type of thing. Bill?
Exactly.
Oh, I thought I lost it.
So here Hynek comes out and says this, and then, again, there's all this public backlash and people saying, this is crazy, this is impossible, how come the Air Force is coming out and saying that this is nothing but swamp gas? And, well, the Michigan, a lot of the Michiganders who had seen these UFOs, and many who just understood that there was something important going on here, they started going to their local politicians, writing letters, making phone calls, saying, you know, do you think we're stupid? This isn't swamp gas. And Gerald Ford, actually, at the time, was a congressman here in Michigan, and he started receiving a lot of letters and calls from his constituents. And he actually, quite soon after the 21st, just 1 week later on the 28th, he sent a letter to the chairman of the Armed Services Committee saying, and I'm going to quote him, too. He says, in the firm belief that the American public deserves a better explanation than that thus far given by the Air Force, I strongly recommend that there be a committee investigation of the UFO phenomena. I think we owe it to the people to establish credibility regarding UFOs and to produce the greatest possible enlightenment of the subject. And, you know, within a decade, he's the president, but you never heard anything else from him about the UFO phenomena after that, that's for sure.
No. I need to interrupt one more time to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and that's 89.3 FM on your radio, WHFR.FM on your computer. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. And we're speaking with the state director for the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, Mr. Bill Konkoleski. We're talking about the Swamp Gas Conference that will take place on March 19th, 2016, here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the Wyndham Gardens Hotel. So, please continue, yeah. Sir.
Yeah, and this is where things really got interesting. This is where Gerald Ford meets J. Allen Hynek, meets the Air Force and Congress. It just all gels when Gerald Ford requests that an open hearing be done on the UFO phenomena, and the Armed Services Committee grants his wish. And shortly after, again, just 1 week after Ford makes his request, they have an open hearing. And G. Allen Hynek shows up at this open congressional hearing on UFOs and says, and he's still stinging because he's upset because he knows what people are saying are anomalous, and he's still bound by the Air Force to say exactly the opposite.
Right. Well,
here he is being called to testify, and so his response, his out is to avoid any more pressure on himself. He says, you don't like what the Air Force has said about this. Why don't you have a civilian group look into it? And the Air Force responded to that and said, yes, we think that's a great idea. In fact, we'll pick out the civilian group who's going to look at this. And so the Air Force took it upon themselves to find somebody that would agree that there was nothing to the phenomena. They went to the University of Colorado, and they had them sort of audit their files and do a sort of independent study based upon Project Blue Book, what was able to provide them. And Edward Condon was the project director out of the University of Colorado on this, and they put out a pretty thick book called The Scientific Study of Unidentified Flying Objects. It's commonly known as the Condon Report. And in this report, they basically shrug and off anything anomalous being behind the UFO phenomena in general, saying, there really isn't much to this whole UFO thing. The Air Force, in turn, turns around and says, we've been saying there's nothing to this UFO thing. Here, this independent, quote-unquote, independent group also says there's nothing about this UFO phenomena. So why don't we just close Project Blue Book? And in December of 1969, Project Blue Book closed. And, you can follow the chain of events here, the big swamp gas event of 66. There's an open congressional hearing. Hynek suggests a civilian group. The Air Force picks a civilian group, and they say there's nothing to the UFO phenomena. One hand shakes the other back again, and the Air Force closes Project Blue Book. And ever since then, the Air Force hasn't had such a public, auspicious UFO investigation project. Clearly, they still investigate UFOs, but the days of them having sort of a public office to report them in such a auspicious way, that's no longer the case.
Well, I understand if you call the Air Force with a UFO report, they refer you to MUFON. Is that correct?
I've heard that, yeah.
I've heard that, too. Now, Hynek was part of Project Blue Book. Did he head it, or was he just part of it?
When you think of heading it, really, there was, if you look at it for example, like the Secretary of the Air Force, Robert Stevens, at the time it closed, I mean, you would say really he was, you know, the head honcho. I mean, it being a military-run project, I mean, you go up the chain of command. But in terms of investigators, I don't know any investigator that was more central to actually being hands-on with the phenomena than Hynek. Mm-hmm. Other people ran the show. They sent him out mission, and you know, he gave his feedback. And really, it was just sort of a public relations thing. It had come out later. I think it was the Bolander memo that said that if there are UFOs that affect national security, those aren't part of Project Blue Book anyway. We keep them on the side.
Yeah, that affect, and yet they said UFOs are not a threat to national security.
Right, and you know, if you look at just what happened in Michigan in 1975, not too long after this, when we had a UFO buzz Wordsmith Air Force Base that housed the nuclear bombers, there's a heck of a lot going on with national security and UFOs.
Plus, our Minuteman missiles were shut down by ours and Russia's were shut down by UFOs, or at least they did shut down while UFOs were in the vicinity.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a two-week period in 1975 that included that mention of Wordsmith Air Force Base I just had. Mm-hmm. Loring Air Force Base, Malmstrom, and Minot, all within a two-week period, all bases that had nuclear weapons, they were all had UFO incursions overhead.
And their missiles were affected, right?
In the cases of either Malmstrom or Minot or both, I think so, yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then there's the case of shoot 'em down. Well, of course that was back with that was back when the about 10 years before that when Truman ordered shoot them down if they don't answer our hail. And
you can try. Yep.
Yeah, you can try, but we lost a lot of pilots as a result of that, right? Because they're defending themselves.
Yeah, there's clearly a whole other history of the United States that we don't hear about.
Oh, yeah. Going back to Hynek now. Hynek was part of the... because they're defending Project Blue Book. Then when they closed Project Blue Book down, what did Hynek do as to UFOs?
Well, he, not long after, in 1972, he freed from the strings of the Air Force, mm-hmm. And looking to clear his name and really get an honest look at the UFO phenomena, he opened up his own group, the Center for UFO Studies, based out of the Chicago area, and he got several good scientific minds on board. It was a small group, and it continues to this day, long after he's passed. But, their goal was to take an honest, hard science look at UFO evidence. And, great group of individuals and, doing their best to look at the UFO mystery from a group of learned people. MUFON is an awesome organization, one of many historically, like, APRO or NICAP or, some of the ones that have come and gone before us. Mm. MUFON's great strength is in its numbers. We have a heavy population of people who are enthusiastic about the phenomena. We're an all-volunteer army. And... we do have some scientists on board as part of our team, but as an all-volunteer army, you get a variety of people with different backgrounds and different strengths, and it's a very large group trying to do a very large task. Mm. Where this particular group, I mean, you could, a lot of people, criticize MUFON and say, oh, anybody can become, a MUFON investigator. Mm-hmm. Well, if they pass a rigid test to become an investigator, they can, yes. But in the case of Kufos, they were, without almost an exception, for many years, all PhDs in their organization.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, their credentials were impeccable, and the way they presented themselves and continued to present themselves,
anybody
is top notch.
Anybody can become a doctor. Anybody can become a lawyer. You know, you might as well say that. Yeah, anybody can, as long as they're trained properly. You know, So why do you think that Hynek was so passionate about the UFO phenomena when he started out as such a skeptic?
Well, again, you might get a good sense of history from somebody from the Center of UFO Studies about where Hynek originally started on the scale. My impression had always been that he came in with an open mind, just hadn't seen any of the evidence.
Right.
That might be not the case. He may have been a most hardened skeptic at the beginning. I'm not certain of that. I just know that he slid on the scale progressively until a point where he knew that he was seeing something that was, you know, the greatest scientific mystery of our time. And as a man of science, he had to continually go out publicly and commit the sin of, you know, saying, giving the wrong results to the wrong, you know, to the evidence that was being collected.
Mm.
And I'm sure that as a man of science, that ate at him and was very rough on him and was very stressful. And so Kufos was his way of saying, you know, trying to make up for all the years where, you know, he was being, his arm was being twisted to lie to the public.
Right. I think it was a Condon report, the trick memo. They refer to it as the trick memo.
Yeah, the when in that particular study, that the Condon report, the University of Colorado did, one of their project coordinators, this guy named Robert Law, he said something to the effect of, in a memo that had been released a little bit later, he said the trick would be to describe the project so that we're being totally objective. But really, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, we really know what's going on. So, you know, we find, you know, we're having an almost zero expectation of finding anything here.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically, you know, with this memo kind of showed the hand of what was obvious anyway, which was that they were trying to massage the data that was already massaged to try to hide that anything interesting is actually going on.
And it was Condon himself that said, at the beginning of it, there's nothing to this UFO thing, but I am not supposed to reach that conclusion for another year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
So, in other words, the conclusion's already there. I just have to fool around for a year and pretend like I'm looking for something when I'm really not. And then at the end of it, I think it was like 22% of the cases they studied could not be explained in conventional terms.
Yeah, see, that's one of the funny things, too, is because here, when I look at a real skeptic, I look at somebody who's open-minded.
Mm.
And in our MUFON organization, we are exactly that. We don't dismiss the UFO phenomena out of hand as being anomalous, clearly not, especially with as many members being witnesses. But, you know, the high volumes of sightings that we get in, like, for example, in Michigan last year, we got 331 sightings in.
Hmm.
Clearly, not all of those are unusual. A lot of them are misidentifications of aircraft, celestial objects, drones, sky lanterns, you know, that sort of a thing, a wide variety of things. And so MUFON doesn't want to be on record as saying that anything that anybody ever reports to us is anomalous, because of course it's not. Only a small minority of things are anomalous. Mm. And when you compare the rough percentage of what we get in, which in some years has been about 20% anomalous, to what the Project Blue Book put out, who tried very hard to show that nothing was anomalous, you know, you still end up with the same rough figure that, a lot of people, whether or not the investigator is being true to the evidence, true to the data or not, there are still some cases where you just can't wash your hands of it and say there was nothing to this.
Right, right. Well, when Hynek said, made the swamp gas comment, he was referring to the people who saw these lights in the sky. You know, he said, you see a little light over here, the gas comes up and ignites, and then it goes out, and you see it over there. It looks like it. But not, he wasn't describing the solid craft that were close enough to see that it was metallic and pitted or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they kind of cherry-pick the evidence they want to evaluate, don't you think?
Yeah, it's all spin. And, people, depending on where on the spectrum that they are, they'll either confabulate sometimes a little bit, or they'll dismiss some things, leave some data points out that would sway the argument one way or the other. It's a really unfortunate business that, a UFO just doesn't land and stay there. And, then there you go. There you have it. But, without something like that, you'll find people spinning it every which way. You know, it's like if you ever try to follow politics on internet news, it's all the same thing. There's some facts in there, but it's really tough to get a real solid picture of it. Right. And I like to think that MUFON is in center spectrum in this case. We get sighting reports. If we can identify them, we will. That's our first mission. And if we can't, that we stop at the water's edge and say, we can't identify this. We don't know what this is.
Right.
We don't jump to conclusions and say, we think this one was probably from Venus. I poke some fun at it, but, I've seen enough myself, to know that there's something to the phenomena, just not everything that's reported is anomalous.
Right, right. No, it's like I always say, after my sighting years ago, I do not dismiss out of hand anyone's report, but it's like Reagan said, trust but verify. I will listen to their report with an open mind, and it's like you say, most of the time you can pretty much say, well, that was a plane, that was a planet Venus. Very rarely is it the planet Venus, because Venus will stay there for quite a while. But the true UFOs do not stay there for quite a while, as a rule. However, there are the crashes, and they stay there for quite a while.
Yep.
And until they're picked up by the government and hidden away somewhere and just said, and then they say, that was just swamp gas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I think a lot of people, in terms of changing perceptions, and I do think that there are some changing perceptions. I think people are, as generation follows generation, people are more open to the idea of life out there in terms of skepticism or disbelief or whatever you want to say about it, I guess. But decades ago, I remember, being younger, people would say, well, we don't even know that there are other planets surrounding other stars. But now we know, that that's very clearly the case.
Yeah.
And in fact, what they're saying now is about 1 in 6 habitable, potentially habitable worlds or moons might actually have some sort of life on them.
Right.
So if you look at the odds of that and say, okay, one estimate is that there's about 300 billion stars in the Milky Way. And if you say, well, okay, if one in six of those worlds around one of these stars, if one in six of these stars has a habitable moon or world around it or whatever, that's what it is. It's not one out of six worlds. It's one out of six stars might have a potentially habitable world. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you multiply the quick and dirty math is you multiply that by, you divide it out of the 300 billion and you actually get 50 billion potentially habitable worlds might be in just the Milky Way alone that could support life.
All right, right, right.
And then if you multiply that by the number of visible galaxies out there, which is about 100 billion right now, you get 5 to the 21st power potentially habitable worlds out there.
You're blowing my mind over here.
So I think for anybody to say there's nothing to this, they're just not, they are fighting against logic.
No.
To say that, you know, from the starting point, without actually looking at the data, without actually looking at the evidence, they're coming from the wrong side of things. Mm. The right side of things is to say, well, 5 to the 21st power, that means there might actually be something here. Let's look to see if there's any evidence. I think that's a slightly fairer approach. And, there's that Fermi's paradox that says, okay, so, yeah, there's a lot of potentially habitable worlds out there, but how come we're not seeing any evidence? Well, I think MUFON constantly does provide evidence that, there are a lot of very suspect things happening that require further investigation.
That's right.
And this 1966 event, I'm going to jump back to and say, this was admittedly a few years before MUFON started as an organization in 1969, though curiously, 1969 was also the year that the Project Blue Book closed, so one of the things that I thought made a very fun MUFON t-shirt that I saw said, we've been doing the job of the Air Force since 1969.
I got to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Bill Konkoleski, State Director for the Michigan Chapter of Mutual UFO Network. And we're talking about the Hillsdale, Ann Arbor, Dexter, you name it, that area of Michigan happened in 1966 that was coined by Mr. J. Allen Hynek as the Swamp Gas Incident, and it's the Swamp Gas Conference. And tell us about the speakers that are going to be at the Swamp Gas Conference.
One of the great things about this conference is a lot of UFO conferences or sometimes paranormal-themed conferences will rightly have a nice mix of different speakers speaking on different types of topics, that sort of a thing. But we think this event is so important from 1966 that the focus of this event is purely on the 1966 event and related topics.
Mm-hmm.
We have two individuals speaking at length about the event, particularly Will Matthews. He lives in Kalamazoo, and he's going to be talking about the 1966 UFO flap in general. Mark O'Connell is going to, another gentleman, he's out of Wisconsin. He's going to be talking about Hynek in particular. And then Bill Murphy, former state director of Michigan MUFON, is going to talk about the Gerald Ford files, all the correspondence that went to Gerald Ford about the particular phenomena.
Mm.
Another former Michigan state director, Harry Wilmuth, he's a PhD. He was also a former state director of Michigan MUFON. He actually he personally investigated the event back in 1966, even before MUFON was in existence, and he's going to be talking. Peter Robbins, a well-known individual and a good friend, is going to be talking about the UFO ridicule factor in the media. And very important in this in particular case. And Grant Cameron, he's going to be our headliner. He's going to talk about how Gerald Ford and other U.S. presidents have handled UFOs and their disclosure to the American public. And then in addition, we've just added John E.L. Tenney, who's going to be talking about his efforts, successful efforts, at getting archival information out of the local newspapers. He's got some pictures of Hynek that are out in the public domain, so that's very exciting for one thing.
Hmm. It sounds like a full day.
Yep, and Linda Murphy, also PhD, is going to be our MC for the event. And she was also a state director of Michigan MUFON at one point, along with her husband, Bill Murphy, who's speaking on the Gerald Ford files.
Right. So this starts at, what, 10 o'clock in the morning?
Yep.
10 o'clock in the morning, goes to 6:30, 6:45. Is that correct?
It'll probably push up into 7 p.m., I imagine. Right. There's a lot of information to get out. I mean, anybody who's interested in this event or wants to hear more, I mean, they're going to come out with us, you know, practically a certificate where they could talk about the event with great authority after leaving a thing like this, because we're going to be very thoroughly reviewing this particular event.
Right.
And a lot of times I'll go out and do presentations, and especially if I do it at a senior center, there'll be people in attendance that say they remember the event quite well, and sometimes I even get people who say they've seen it themselves. This is very well remembered here locally, and the media, local media, seems to love it. Every time there's any sort of big UFO event recently, I'm always asked about. When I'm asked about it, I'm also asked about this 1966 event. They like to tie it into that.
So that's March 19th to 2016 at the Wyndham Gardens, Ann Arbor Hotel. And tell us about what's going on with MUFON in general recently.
Well, our organization is going through a very good, strong phase, in great part because of the Hangar One television show.
Right.
A lot of people see that, and, you know, the name of MUFON gets out there. And it certainly has shown in the number of reports people have sent to us, because that's on the upswing again. And one of the great things that we have available to us now is our scientific review board every year looks over the 10 best cases from the previous year. We don't have 2015s yet, but what this board did, for example, in 2014, we had a group of individuals look at nearly 9,000 cases and come up with, you know, some of the best ones that they thought and some of the strongest cases they thought from around the country. And most of them are in the U.S. because most of the U.S., most of the membership for MUFON is within the U.S., even though we do have an international presence as well. But, yeah, you find some really fascinating cases. And there was one from last year. It was in Arizona, I believe. And it was a police officer who had he was on patrol. It was in the middle of the night. And he had seen... I'm trying to think. It was actually, did I say Arizona? It was Colorado.
In Colorado.
Pardon me. Yeah, it was in Colorado. It was in a suburb of Denver. And a police officer was driving past a park in the middle of the night, and he saw these glowing balls of light floating through the park. And he went in to investigate, and when he got there, the UFO was gone, or the UFOs, because there were several small balls of light. And so... you know, you think, okay, you know, here's a law officer, and he's reported something. But then he realized, hey, you know, this particular park where he was at has a surveillance camera. So sure enough, I checked out the surveillance camera, and I'd seen the footage. Yeah, you see these glowing balls of light flowing through the trees, and then you see the police car driving past it. So something was there that particular night.
So there's video evidence of this. Right.
Yep, and that's one of the, you know, the things that people always ask for, photos, video evidence. There were some other great pictures out of Missouri, a teenager, 14-year-old kid who was in the car with his mom, took several photos outside the window of a UFO flying overhead, and those are some pretty good pictures.
Yeah, the problem is, you know, they say, well, where's the photographic evidence? Where's the video evidence? And you know, there is no photographic video evidence. And you lay all of this video evidence and photographic evidence in front of them, and what do they say? I can do that on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
I can do that with Photoshop, you know? So you can't win. But yeah, I think it goes along with the credibility of the witness as well. If they say, I saw this with my naked eye. Now, I see a lot of pictures that they say, I didn't see this with my naked eye until I started looking at the pictures.
I don't trust it. So those ones, yeah, are tough often because yeah. A lot of times there's something that's happened with the photo. I mean, sure enough, you have people that will hoax pictures and say that, but you also find people who, you know, get some sort of lens flare in that they didn't expect, and,
right.
You know, they're not familiar with, you know, that artifact, you know, appearing in their pictures generally. And,
right.
You know, they're convinced that something's in the picture when it's really not the case, and that's unfortunate.
And it's usually a picture that where they're pointing the camera right into the sun or into the moon or into a street light, you know. And they, oh, look mm-hmm. at that orb over there. Yeah, you're going to get that virtually every time when, you know, don't point your camera at the sun.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still the case with the modern generation of cell phone cameras, to tell you the truth, but I know just as recently as a few years ago, we were getting all sorts of people taking pictures of the sun, and there would be this black pixel right in, you know, in the sunlight, and they would use that as, you know, their evidence that, you know, they had caught something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always frustrating to me is that these are those types of things that were making it into the local news.
Right.
We would have some really incredible stories going on in our organization, and then somehow somebody would send a goofy picture into the local paper, and that would be the UFO press that would come out.
All right. Several years back, I think you remember this case. Where was it? East Detroit. It was East Detroit. This UFO, a typical disc-shaped UFO, hovered over his house, and he snapped several pictures of it on his cell phone. And he thought he had the proof that UFOs existed. The kid was like 20, 21. And, you know, where has he been? You know, like he had the only photograph of a UFO.
Yeah, if I remember right, he was offering $400 for us to purchase them off of him.
Right. He wanted to sell these. But, you know, he was going to make a fortune with his evidence. And, in fact, the news, a news truck happened to be in the area and went out there, one of the local stations. And, of course, the thing had departed by the time they got there. But he showed them the pictures. So they messed, the news photographer messed around with his camera, trying to mess his focus up and everything, and taking a picture of the sun, messing the focus up, saying, see, I can almost duplicate that. All it was a blotch of light. Didn't look anything like the photograph the kid had taken. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, it's as if the narrative is not valued, just what you can look at and then try to make some determination of its validity. When, yeah, some of these pictures can be faked, and some of the real photographic evidence can look pretty poor. I remember back in 1994 in the Grand Rapids area, there were several hundred UFO witnesses in the spring of 1994, that particular year. And yeah, there were a lot of pictures and there were a lot of videos, but they were basically, when you look at them, there were white streaks in the sky, and you listen to the witness and, you know, you're compelled to say, yeah, this person saw something that did some pretty incredible things in the night sky, most certainly not an airplane or some other celestial object. Mm-hmm. And then they show you their picture, their video, and, you know, unfortunately, it's not good enough to support their very strong story.
Right.
And then you have people with poor stories coming out with, you know, pretty good, what looks to be pretty good UFO photographic evidence. Mm-hmm. And then you find the person with the right technology to blow it up, and you see it's a bird.
Right. A bird or a bug. And that's the kind of evidence that or stories that the media will hold up to the public and say, you see, this is the their evidence. And when in actuality, there is a lot of UFO evidence. And people are coming forward now with the Disclosure Project and all over. And they're... they used to be with the government, retired with military, and they were insiders, and they're coming forward. And the more they come forward, the more other people will come forward with their stories. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you have a strong event that is very hard to dismiss, like this 1966 event, you don't let it just drift into history. While there's still a lot of people out there that remember the event and can speak on it with some authority of memory, you want to put this out there as one of the big things that have happened in UFO history that people should look at.
Yeah. And I would venture to say that this Swamp Gas Conference is the biggest event that Michigan has had since the 2003 Symposium in Dearborn.
Right.
Yeah. And we got some good names, reliable witnesses, reliable researchers, and PhDs and what have you. And a lot of people say, oh, those MUFON people, they wear tin foil hats and this, that, and the other. And you go into it, and you find there are PhDs and scientists and doctors and intelligent people that are, and then just average people, average everyday people who have witnessed some extraordinary things.
Yeah, we all share the mystery. I mean, people from every walk of life. It's just that, you know, for some professionals that are are valuable members of our team in terms of the field of science, unfortunately, they're field is based upon them getting grants to do research, and UFO grants don't come very easily, apparently.
And I don't think so. Yeah. In fact,
they're volunteers just like the rest of us.
In fact, you lose your grant if you go talking about it.
Yeah.
So, Bill, once again, give us the information on the Swamp Gas Conference and where that goes.
The conference, information on the conference and tickets can be picked up through swampgasufo.com. If you want to know more about our state organization supporting that's putting on this event and want to come to our local meetings too, we put on local meetings several times a year in the Flint area, and our state website is minufon.org. MI for Michigan, MUFON for Mutual UFO Network. So again, it's MIMUFON.org. Or MUFON.com is our parent organization.
Very good. Very good. Thank you so much. And Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope we can do this again. And I hope we have a very successful Swamp Gas Conference.
Right? Very well.
Okay, but thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage. then Tuesday Forum. And We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.